I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Ken Stanley. He's a computer scientist, he's an artificial intelligence researcher, an associate professor at the University of Central Florida, and on sabbatical this year at the Santa Fe Institute. And he's co-author with Joel Lehman of the new book, Why Greatness Cannot Be Planned, The Myth of the Objective. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. I'm really happy to be here.
It's really been such a pleasure and so interesting reading your book. And the book is about the fact that we live in this world which is very much focused on goals and objective and measurable results, from everything to quarterly profits to rock hard flat abs to test scores to finding true love. We assign goals and measurable results to all those kinds of things. You're making the case that measurable objectives are actually more of an obstacle than a help in many cases, and that a lot of the most important discoveries in human civilization have been made when people weren't really looking, when they didn't have the goal, or certainly not the goal to discover that thing. What are some examples of that?
Yeah, that's right. And it is, I think, really important to go through a few examples, because the broader point that we use goals to basically guide all our endeavors is really a big problem for us if it actually isn't the way that great things get done. So just a couple examples. I mean, there's a lot of examples of serendipitous discovery, and people are familiar with that idea. And you know, one of the classic examples is like Percy Spencer, who had a candy bar in his pocket that basically melted when he was walking by some radar machinery. And that gave him the idea for a microwave. So he wasn't trying to make a microwave or a microwave oven, but he did just kind of run into it serendipitously through his other work. But we can see this kind of phenomenon in many spheres. Like, for example, the invention of rock and roll was not intentional. You know, and there's examples, there's a lot of text written about, say, Elvis and how he was just playing around.
There's a quote in your book that I'd like to read about Elvis, if I may. A guitarist who played with Elvis looked back on that sort of fertile moment and said, all of a sudden, Elvis just started singing this song, jumping around and acting the fool. And then Bill picked up his bass and he started acting the fool too. And I started playing with them. And then the recording engineer stuck his head out and said, what are you doing? And we said, we don't know.
Right. Yeah. And I think that the point there is that nobody had the objective of inventing rock and roll. And that's why it was invented. You know, and how many things actually worked like that in our history? You know, and actually, I think it's an important point that this isn't only about obvious serendipity, like those are very serendipitous cases, but there's more subtle serendipity that's behind almost every invention. So for example, like the computer. The computer seems like, you might think that somebody tried to build a computer and then they did, so it was an objective, and then, you know, that's how it happened. But actually, the pieces that went into the computer were built by people who were not trying to build computers. And this, I think, is a really important factor behind almost every invention that's ever been made. So, for example, in the history of computation, the first computers were made out of vacuum tubes. But the people who built vacuum tubes, who invented vacuum tubes and developed them, were not thinking of computation at all. They were doing electrical experiments. So that particular component, which was essential to eventually building a computer, would not have been built if the goal had been to build a computer, which is a paradox. And that's why we need to be worried if we're always measuring progress towards a specific objective, because those particular kind of offshoots or digressions that eventually lead to these great discoveries would never actually get done.
One of the things that's really important in so many of these examples is that the people who are making these discoveries, whether it's rock and roll, whether it's the computer, whether it's the microwave oven, they're really immersed in their field and they're really paying attention.
Yeah, that's another very important point, you know, because a lot of the time when we hear stories about serendipity, we kind of think of it as an accident, or like someone could just be kind of doing something crazy, running around randomly, and then they sort of bump into an idea by accident. But if you really look at the history, it's usually people who are prepared for these kinds of accidents. You know, they're usually well-educated or experienced or have some talent. In fact, there's an interesting page if you're interested in serendipity on Wikipedia, just under the word serendipity. And if you look at the examples there, there's a lot of them, and almost everybody who's had these kind of discoveries is somebody who had a really good track record, you know, which is suspicious if you really think it's an accident. So part of the message of the book is that the ability to have this kind of serendipitous discovery is not really an accident. It's something that we can prepare for, and I'm sure we'll get more into that. And that's actually an important factor in a lot of discovery that happens, you know, throughout our culture, but something that is not encouraged when we're explicitly following objectives.
It seems that artists and musicians and people who are in overtly creative fields intuitively understand this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had some experience with that when I visited the Rhode Island School of Design a few years ago, and I actually gave a talk there on this subject. And it was just an amazing experience to me. It's actually part of what led me to be motivated with my co-author, Joel Lehman, to write this book. Because what I found was that when I talked about how pervasive objectives are in our culture and how much of a problem that is and how many great things happen without or despite objectives, it seemed almost to have like a palpable emotional resonance with the audience. It wasn't just like we're talking about facts. It was almost like some kind of therapy where they finally heard a kind of release or catharsis for like the way that they had been feeling for so long when, you know, everything around them is, you know, drilling into them. What is your objective? What are you trying to accomplish? Why are you building this very strange thing or painting this strange, pointless thing? There was one guy in particular that really stuck with me, his story. He visited me after the talk, and he wanted to tell me about something that he did that he always felt that it was very hard for him to justify or explain to people. They always wanted to know, why are you doing this? And what it was that he would basically take an axe to some metal, so just perform some violence on it, and then throw it in the ocean, and then stick it on the beach overnight to rust. And that's basically his art, and that's what he does, and he's an expert on that. And so, you know, he doesn't know why he wants to do that. But, you know, this kind of idea, I think, of violence and then mellowing and then sort of encapsulating that or crystallizing that in some kind of piece of art, maybe it has, you know, its own beauty that can lead to other things without knowing where it's necessarily going. I mean, it may resonate with you. It may lead to other artistic ideas. But for him, it was basically a release to know that he doesn't have to explain that.
It's interesting to me that, I mean, artists understand this. There's also a lot of resonance with spiritual ideas, like some Buddhist or Zen points of view that it's not about the destination, it's about the journey and things like that, and about being fully present in the moment. You guys are hardcore computer scientists. How did you come across these ideas in your work?
Yeah, so this is an interesting story. I mean, if you're listening to this, you're probably wondering, why is a computer scientist talking about this Zen stuff? And I am basically a hardcore computer scientist by trade. But it's something that we stumbled into. So it's almost like the story behind this book and the idea behind this book itself is basically an example of the principle in the book, which is serendipity. We were running an experiment in our lab which was really supposed to reveal some facts about artificial intelligence. And this experiment ended up actually exposing this principle, which I would call like the objective paradox.
When you say the objective paradox, you mean, if I understand it correctly, the paradox that the more you look for something, the less you find it. The less you look for something, the more ripe you are to find things.
Yes, thank you for the clarification. That's what I mean by the objective paradox. It's that trying to achieve something can actually stop you from achieving anything, which is very paradoxical and counterintuitive. And that's really what the book is about.
So you were doing some kind of artificial intelligence experiment in your lab that led you to come across what you call the objective paradox. What were you doing?
Right. So what we were doing, and you know, at first this will sound completely unrelated, so just you got to bear with me, is basically we were making a website where people could come in from the internet and breed pictures. And I know that probably the audience doesn't know what that means exactly. How do you breed a picture? Like a Van Gogh doesn't mate with a Picasso or something like that. But we created a technology, and this is sort of where the AI comes in, where you can actually cause a picture to have offspring. And just like if you were breeding horses or dogs or something like that, in this pick breeder website, you can actually ask a picture to have babies.
By the way, ladies and gentlemen, it's on the web at pickbreeder.org. And I myself, while I was reading this book, took about 50 breaks to breed pictures. And it was a very interesting process. But go ahead.
Right. So yeah, you can visit it now. It's still around. It's been around for about 7 years. And there's about 10,000 images that have been bred. But so what happens on this site is basically, there's different ways of starting, but let me just give an example of how you might start. Like one way you might start is what's called from scratch. And what will happen is the website will put on your screen a bunch of basically random blobs. Those are the pictures that you have a choice of breeding. And then you choose the one that you like the best, just like you might choose the fastest horse or something like that if you were breeding horses. So here you choose the best picture. In your view, it's up to you what you think is the best. And then you can say make offspring. And that picture will then create a whole new generation of pictures which are related to it but not exactly the same. Just as your children, you know, look a bit like you but aren't exactly like you. And as you can imagine, this is just sort of intuitively like breeding. If you keep doing that over and over, you keep picking your favorite picture, and then you get a new generation, and then you pick your favorite from that, and so forth and so on. What you're really doing is you're evolving an image, or evolving art, you could say. And over time, maybe it goes in a direction that somehow reflects your personality or your preferences or something like that.
I have to say, I did this and I kept breeding dogs.
Yeah.
Which is my favorite animal. It's very strange because I didn't do that on purpose.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, and a lot of people have an experience like that where it's almost like they learn something about themselves, you know, because it kind of something comes out and you say, well, how did that happen? And it really it's because that's kind of stuff you like at some level. Maybe it's subconscious even. So there's one other actually point about Pick Breeder that's important to try to understand what's going on there. So you can sort of see that there's all these people coming in and breeding pictures. But there's a way that we set it up intentionally to let people really build on each other's discoveries. And this is one of the really interesting things about the site is that you can actually publish your discovery, like in other words, something that you bred that you thought was cool, you could put it on the site so that others who come in later then could breed from it. And so you can start with something that someone else actually discovered. So that means there's all this branching going on. We call it branching where, you know, I discover a butterfly and then you take it and you evolve it into a bat or something like that. So here's the interesting part. This is where this connects in. We started to notice a phenomenon, and it was a really surprising phenomenon, which was that we discovered that when people evolved really interesting stuff, which they often did, I mean, we have cars, we have butterflies, we have a skull, we have just amazing things. You wouldn't believe that these things were evolved from blobs. You might think that actually if you saw it and you came in, like you see this skull, it looks like a bona fide skull, you might think, oh, well, somebody must have wanted to evolve a skull, and then they just bred towards the skull as an objective. And this is where objectives come into it. This is what we discovered, is that actually all of those interesting things were discovered only when they were not the objective of the person who discovered them. And this was just like mind-blowing. It's totally not what I was expecting. I actually ran into it because when I first realized this principle, it was from my own use of the site. Actually, I evolved the car. And the story is I started from an alien face. Someone else had evolved an alien face. And I was thinking, you know what? I'm going to take this alien face and make more alien faces, and it'll be like a cool alien face collection. But what happened was that the eyes of the alien face started to descend over the process of breeding. They got lower and lower on the face. And I just suddenly realized there was a moment of serendipity where I realized, oh my God, this is becoming a car. The eyes had become wheels. And that's when I realized I could get to a car. And that moment was like a big epiphany in my whole life because it went against everything I've ever been taught about how you achieve things. You know, my understanding of achievement, and this is also something that's drilled into you in computer science and machine learning, is that you set a goal and you measure your progress towards your goal and you make progress by getting closer to the goal. But here I was, I basically found one of the most amazing images on the site, which is this car, and I had explicitly not been trying to evolve a car. And in fact, if I had been trying to evolve a car, I would not have succeeded.
Which you actually tried. I mean, you went back and tried to evolve certain images and couldn't do it.
Yes, we did. I mean, after we sort of noticed this principle, just to kind of drive it home, we actually set up a special computer program to choose things intentionally that looked more and more like some objective, like, say, a butterfly or a car. And we found that, yes, it fails miserably when it's set as an objective. These things can only be discovered when they are not the objective. And I think it's just important to clarify just one point of why that is, just in the kind of example of the car. You know, why is it that I could not evolve a car if I had been trying to? And one of the reasons is that I would not have started with that alien face because it's not a car. Now, the only way I could start with the alien is if I'm not thinking about cars, which shows you just how dangerous it is to constantly be constrained by your objective.
Very, very interesting. So this, it turns out, I mean, somebody might be listening and saying, so what, you have evolved an alien face on a little graphics site from a, you know, evolved a car from an alien face. Okay, right. That's great. But it turns out that this is a metaphor for some much larger processes that are happening in the world, not only the artistic process, but as we've been talking about, the scientific process and so many other things. And it seems that these stepping stones, whether it be in a picture breeder or anything else, are a real metaphor for the process of discovery.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's really important to view that story as a really deep metaphor for just discovery in general. You know, I might have been evolving pictures, but you know, I could have been trying to invent something. And in that case, the stepping stone would have been an invention that someone else had come up with before, and I maybe started from that. You're always starting from the stepping stones that have been laid by your predecessors. And in some sense, where we can get is very much constrained by where we've been. You know, so if there are inventions that exist in the world or discoveries, like the alien face in that example, then that actually is creating potential for new discoveries. But the thing that we just don't know is where those stepping stones may lead. And this is kind of the deep revelation that was behind this. It is strange that, like, you know, you'd come to some really broad social commentary from trying to evolve pictures on a website. But you can imagine this was a process that sort of unfolded over years, realizing that the implications of this insight were like much, much broader. And broader and broader. And the more we thought about it, the more we realized that this applies to almost everything, this idea of stepping stones.
There are so many examples of stepping stones from the history of technology, from the history of science, even from, I mean, contemporary internet stuff. In your book, you talk about how YouTube started as a dating site, and then one thing led to another, and it became this incredible video sharing platform that it is now. Once you got this concept of stepping stones, where did you go with that as a computer scientist?
Yeah, so it's sort of natural for us as computer scientists, once we see a concept like this, to try to somehow formalize it and make it something that you can actually run in a computer. And I know it sounds a little weird because we're talking about life now. But if you think about it, discovery can be thought of almost like a program, like something that tries to search out through the possibilities and find the interesting things. And, you know, I'm in artificial intelligence, so it's kind of what we try to do, actually, is to actually make programs that discover and solve problems, discover things and solve problems. So we actually tried to formalize this idea of stepping stone collection. So basically, what PicBreeder shows, or what all of these examples show from our culture, is that it's really important to have all these stepping stones sort of available so that other people can pick up on them and then go forward in all kinds of directions, not necessarily in a particular objective direction, but in any direction. And so I call that like a stepping stone collector, a system that collects possible jumping off points that can lead to somewhere new. Another way I sometimes call it is a treasure hunter. It's like you're trying to find cool stuff, but not anything in particular, just all the treasures that are out there. And so we wanted to kind of program like one of these treasure hunting systems, something that just accumulates interesting things and then gets more interesting things from those. So we created an algorithm, or basically a computer program, called Novelty Search that does this automatically. So there's no humans involved anymore, and basically embodies this principle. So basically what it does is, as an example, it basically can work with a robot. So just to make this concrete, like we could say that this robot is going to try to do something, and we're going to facilitate that kind of discovery. What we're going to do is we're going to collect novel behaviors from the robot. So normally in the field of machine learning, you'd be trying to improve the robot's behavior with respect to some objective. But our algorithm, this novelty search algorithm, doesn't care about improving with respect to an objective. All it cares about is collecting new behaviors. And then what it does is it looks at those new behaviors, and then it tweaks them a bit to see if it can get even more new behaviors. So it's basically an embodiment of a stepping stone collector. And what we found was that we were able, with this very strange counterintuitive method of basically collecting new behaviors without any goal in mind, to actually achieve behaviors that solve problems or achieve objectives better than a program that's actually trying to achieve them.
So there's this example of like a simple maze that you want the robot to be able to get out the other side. And if you try to program the robot to get through the other side of the maze, your success rate was, I think it was 3 times out of 40, something like that.
Right.
And if you program the robot to just do new things, so it crash into a wall, well, then the next time it crashes into a different wall, and the next time it crashes into a third wall, the next time it falls down, it'll keep doing that. It won't crash into the same wall twice because that's not new. It'll keep doing new things. It got out of the maze 39 times out of 40.
Right. So that makes the example concrete. So this is one of the classic experiments, and there's been many experiments with novelty search since then. But in this experiment, yeah, there's this idea that crashing into a wall, like normally in, if we were trying to train a robot, that would be seen as a bad thing. You'd think, well, that's not at all going towards our objective. But in this paradigm, suddenly crashing into a wall is a good thing as long as it's a new wall, as long as it's a new kind of a crash.
And that makes me think a lot about child development and education. Because when you see little kids running around in preschool or kindergarten or on the playground or whatever, they don't have the objective to become a good athlete or a good student. They're playing, and in so doing, are becoming good athletes and good students.
Yeah, I mean, this really raises a lot of questions about how we think about how we train people or teach people or let people teach themselves. I mean, just think about the idea that it was very important on the road to finding a robot that actually could solve the maze to have robots that crash into walls. Like, what does that say about children who are making mistakes and that we're trying to correct to prevent from making those mistakes because those are not serving their objective? I mean, it really implies we have to facilitate creative or playful discovery as sort of part of a normal development process. And that seems intrinsic in childhood. I mean, children just naturally seem to have this instinct.
And they also don't really do that well when they're continually pressured with objectives.
Yeah, I mean, we all have a kind of intuition about that, you know, that the objective becomes like a straitjacket around people's growth and development. But when we put it into practice, we really don't follow this intuition. I mean, we completely constrain the education system with objectives and metrics, and everybody has to be moving towards targets. This is how we're running our society. So, you know, what are we losing because of that?
I was thinking about your idea of novelty. And okay, so you've got a robot that uses novelty to not only achieve ends, but to learn every possible thing about its environment, very much the way children do. They're running around and looking at worms and leaves and trying to figure out all about their environment and running into the boundaries of their environment, their parents, whatever. And that's the way they learn, and they're continually seeking out novelty. Then, as adults, there's this thing that happens that sometimes, I mean, I wonder if there's a limit to the value of seeking out novelty. I mean, there's people who are continually dating new people and they never stick to one person, or continually trying to find new lines of work because they get bored with what they're doing. And there is a depth that's missing when you're continually seeking out novelty. And I don't know if this is relevant to the conversation we're having.
I think it's a really interesting question. And I think that the answer is that you can seek novelty in depth. And in fact, that's more what I'm talking about. So I think this really goes to the heart of an important issue. So in the example of dating, if you go to a new partner, for example, so you found someone you like, but now you leave them and find someone else you like, that's not really following stepping stones. I mean, it's not like the first partner naturally leads to the next one. They really aren't related to each other. It would make more sense, it's more natural in, with the metaphor of following stepping stones, to go deeper down the path you're on, which means that you find novelty inside of or beyond just meeting that partner. Now we find new things to share with each other. And those are still novelties, but it's really we're following that path that's sort of been laid by coming together at the beginning. So, you know, novelty is really about going deep.
This whole set of issues about objectives or lack of objectives, it seems like biological evolution is the most basic example of what you're talking about. I mean, in evolution, you know, just in the picture breeder, every picture evolved from a blob. Well, on some level, we evolved from blobs, right? Little bacteria in the primordial soup. One organism leads to another. One trait leads to another. But bacteria didn't have an objective of achieving multicellularity, and apes didn't have the objective of becoming Homo sapiens and tool makers and recorders of wisdom. And yet, evolution is very much about these stepping stones.
Right. So, I mean, this is another example of just how all-encompassing this insight is. You know, now we're talking about evolution and we were talking about dating a little while ago. But it really applies strongly in evolution. And actually, I come from an area of artificial intelligence called evolutionary computation. So actually, a lot of this stuff comes from evolutionary thinking. And evolution, this whole idea has really caused us to revisit and rethink sort of the way that we interpret what's going on in evolution. You know, one of the insights I think it raises that what you asked me points to is that the reason that evolution as a process of discovery, and you can think of evolution on Earth as a discovery process, all these organisms are kind of discoveries of evolution, but the reason that it's discovering all these amazing things like you and me or other animals or organisms are all just amazingly complex is explicitly because we are not the objective of the process. You know, evolution is, in effect, one of these stepping stone collectors. It's just finding lots of stuff that leads to lots of other stuff, and it's not going anywhere in particular. It's kind of going everywhere, and that's why it does so many great things. So it's just another example of a treasure hunting process. And I think that's a really important insight about evolution on Earth because we so often think of it as an objective process. When we talk about it informally, we often talk about sort of this Darwinian dog-eat-dog situation, survival of the fittest, where like there's this goal of survival or reproduction. But that sort of misses the maybe larger picture that really what's making this work is not this kind of dog-eat-dog objective process, but rather the fact that it's collecting all these jumping-off points and doesn't have an explicit objective.
And so what is driving evolution? I mean, survival and reproduction are part of it, but you're saying they're not the objective.
Yeah, so in the book, we get really into this sort of how should we interpret evolution in light of this insight? And, you know, you can't deny that survival and reproduction are important. Obviously, you have to, for your lineage to persist, you must survive and reproduce. But I prefer to call that a constraint. You know, in the sense that even the very first cell on Earth did survive and reproduce. And usually when we think of objectives, you know, when we speak to each other informally, we're not talking about something we already accomplished. You know, but survival and reproduction has always been accomplished from the very beginning. So it's really a constraint on what can happen. It's not a destination that we're driving towards. In terms of destinations, those are in some ways digressions from survival and reproduction. Or rather, it's just what evolution has really done, which is a really interesting way to think about it, is just discover millions and millions of ways to riff on the theme of survival and reproduction.
Which makes it sound like a fundamentally creative and almost artistic process, which I have to say, I mean, when you look at I'm looking out the window here at the Santa Fe Institute where we're recording this interview, and one couldn't even count how many hundreds or thousands of species we're looking at just in this little area which looks sort of arid and has trees growing on it. But I mean, the expression in nature and the kind of richness of it and beauty of it and apparent creativity of it, you can't help but notice that.
Yeah, I mean, and this is something we contemplate a lot in the book, sort of where that comes from. And, you know, one way to look at it that's kind of strange, but maybe brings a lot of new ideas, is that the only thing that any organism out there really had to do was to get from one cell to another. In other words, all of us began as a single cell. And eventually, if we reproduced, and thereby are successful in some evolutionary sense, then we created another cell. And that really is very simple. I mean, the very first organism, or say a single-celled organism, can just do that by splitting. So everything else that happens is a kind of Rube Goldberg-like digression from like the basic principle of just making one cell from another. And if you think about all this like amazing diversity and beauty out there in the world, it's kind of just riffing on the theme and digressing from this simple principle of just creating one cell from another, saying, what are all of the unbelievably complex ways we could just accomplish that very same thing? And if you think of it as this kind of treasure hunter that's just finding all these different ways, it doesn't care if it's good or bad. Or I mean, it's debatable, actually, what's better. You know, there's more biomass on Earth from bacteria than there is from humans. So in some sense, they're actually beating us in the evolutionary race. But it just gets more interesting is actually what's important to us. You know, as we create more and more complex Rube Goldbergian ways of kind of just getting from one cell to another, we find that increasingly interesting and fascinating. And we're just this massive trillion cell digression from that very simple bottleneck of just getting from one cell to another.
So as creatures, whether we're bacteria or humans or whatever, we naturally riff off of what came before, which may be a little different from what came before, which we know mutation leads to all sorts of evolutionary changes. But one of the things that's just so interesting about it is that there seems to be a fundamental drive to explore. And yes, there's competition, but part of this exploration is you're finding ways to get away from competition. And you write about this in the book.
Yeah, so evolutionary metaphors often involve competition sort of as a central aspect. And this competition, in my view, is a very objective concept, you know, because basically what it means is that some individual is being compared to some other individual with respect to some metric, objective metric, like how well you perform some task, and sort of the winner is objectively superior. But if you think about it, if that's really what this world is like, I mean, I don't deny that part of the world is like that. Everybody knows there is competition in nature. But is that overall what the world is like? And if you think about what the world is really like, if it was like that, then we would all be converging very quickly to a single point. Because all of those who were inferior would be basically lopped out of the search space. So they wouldn't be considered and they wouldn't persist and we wouldn't see where their lineages lead. And we'd all converge very quickly to sort of this uber competitive organism. And that would drain all the diversity out of the system. So competition is not really the right overall metaphor for what's happening. It's much more divergence, I think. So we are existing inside of a divergent system. And divergence means getting away from, not moving towards something. So we're moving away from each other in the sense that when you do found a new niche, you've gotten away from the competition in the old niche. And now we have more diversity to work from and to jump off from in the future.
And so when some little creature finds that it can digest something that no other creature has been able to eat and digest, suddenly it has no competition. It has its own little niche.
Right. So we've escaped competition. And now that niche becomes a stepping stone that can lead to new things. And, you know, if you think about overall, like the whole system in aggregate, what does it all mean? It's almost like somebody just kind of spilled milk somewhere in the space of possible creatures, and it just keeps on spilling outward. The only obstacles to that spill are places where you can't survive. So those things we don't get to see where they go. So you can think of almost like in this metaphor as those sort of like walls blocking the spill, but everywhere else it will go. And those are those new niches being founded.
So if we think of this whole set of ideas that you're talking about in terms of purpose, there is no real purpose. There is no real goal. Evolution isn't leading inexorably toward some destination. Our lives aren't leading inexorably toward some destination except death, which certainly isn't our goal.
Right.
We want to do other things along the way. And so on some level, I mean, here you are talking about artificial intelligence and robotics, and what I'm getting out of it is life is about the journey.
Yeah. And you hear so many quotes like this. I mean, one of the things we say is, you know, to achieve your highest goals, you must be willing to abandon them. But we see this phenomenon all over the place. And the evolution is one example. So it's like, yeah, we are not the goal of evolution. Birds are not the goal. And that's why all of these great things are happening. And so it's true, you can live your life, you know, however you want. You might actually guide your entire life by an objective. But if you really digest this principle that we're discussing, if you want to achieve amazing things, you know, just really creative, out there discoveries, then that may not be the best way to guide your life.
There's a quotation that you have from Count Basie, where he said, if you're going to come up with a new direction or a really new way to do something, you'll do it just by playing your stuff and letting it ride. The real innovators did their innovating by just being themselves.
Yeah, and I mean, that could seem like a little bit difficult to grasp. Like, what does that really mean you should be doing? But I think the real interpretation of that kind of sentiment is that we are greatly overemphasizing the importance of justifying what we're doing through objectives. You know, so many great things happen by just sort of doing, being yourself, and as it said. And what kind of the whole book is about and the things we've been discussing is that this isn't just a philosophy that I'm expressing, like sort of I have this wishy-washy feeling that everybody should just do what they want. What we're talking about here is based on scientific evidence now. That's why it becomes interesting. You know, when we look at PickBreeder, we look at the novelty search experiments, we actually see evidence for the idea that often you should not have an objective if, in principle, you really want to achieve something great. And so I think what it can do is it can really liberate people to realize this, you know, that if your instinct tells you that I just want to do this, and I have a very strong feeling this is the direction I want to go, but I can't tell you where it's going to lead, that's okay. In fact, it's not just okay, but it actually is probably better if you're trying to do something that might lead to a really amazing result.
We're talking to computer scientist Ken Stanley. Now, let's say you have that feeling like, I don't know why I want to do this, but I really want to do it. What is that?
Yeah, so the way I say it is, I think humans have a nose for the interesting. Like, we kind of know that if I take this path, it just smells interesting. I can't really tell you where it's going. It's intuition. And we don't respect that very much. You know, we're very afraid of risk in our culture, and that's why the word accountability has become so popular. But when we feel like something might be the right way to go, sometimes it's not, but sometimes it is. I mean, this is a matter of risk. But the very best people, the most talented people, are very good at actually making that kind of determination, even though they can't justify it objectively. So we are ultimately hampering those people from doing great things by kind of constraining them with this objective straitjacket and saying, well, you better tell me or prove that this is actually going in the right direction before I help you or give you money or let you do what you want to do.
Which speaks to things like, I mean, there are so many parents who are saying to their children, how are you going to make a living by doing that, by studying art? And sometimes that kid has a really deep intuition that that's what they need to do. And even if they don't end up being an artist, that becomes a stepping stone for them to do something else. There's a question that really arises from what you're talking about, which is, okay, we have a society, and you're very deep in it, the world of science, in which, I mean, people give out jobs and money, and they have their quarterly reports in which they want to see profits and all this. We live in a world that's governed by objectives and metrics. How should we do it differently?
Yeah, so I mean, this is something I've become really worried about since having this insight about the objective paradox, is that we really do run our society based on objectives. I mean, like in science, for example, which you mentioned, we only fund grants, for example, scientific grants for people to pursue their scientific ideas, if there's a clear objective and if some panel, for example, thinks that that objective is achievable. And if you think in terms of what I've said so far, I mean, that's just a disaster waiting to happen. I mean, it's pruning out all the stepping stones. And so that raises this question, though, and this is the natural next question, the question you asked, which is, so what is the right way that we should behave? You know, you might think that what I'm saying sounds like it's just this kind of amorphous, like, well, just do whatever you want and everything great will happen. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying, and this is, I think, a really key point for this whole discussion, is that there is a principled way to make this kind of process happen, this kind of treasure hunting process. We've seen it in PickBreeder. We see it in biological evolution. We even see it in human innovation as a whole, which is that systems that are designed to proliferate and share stepping stones, or these treasure hunting systems, are the ones that lead to the greatest discoveries. And so when we talk about society and how society should try to facilitate these kinds of things, we need to create our systems in such a way that they facilitate collecting stepping stones.
So do you have any examples of how that might work on the ground?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the examples that I discuss, and I guess it gets into political territory, but it's still just interesting to think about, because I'm really talking about it not from a political perspective, but from this sort of objective, theoretic, optimization theoretic perspective, is like the education system. I mean, that is so saturated with objectives. So, like, for example, like, we want everybody to score really high on tests, and this has caused a lot of controversy recently with these kind of standardized testing that's just basically saturating the school system. And so we actually rate schools on sort of how well students are doing on average, and this is very objective-based. based, because we have an objective, which is for everybody in the school to do really great. And so people would say, well, but what else can we do? We need accountability. This is the only way that we can get things to improve. But there is a non-objective alternative, and this is just one example of, I'm not saying this is the solution to everything, but just to give an example that we could think differently. We could arrange this system instead as a stepping stone collector. So we could still have accountability in the sense that people could be judged for how they're doing, but instead of having all these standardized tests, like teachers could, for example, create a portfolio that they share with other teachers who then rate their peers or something like that, or write a report saying how well is this person doing at the end of the year. And what that would do is it would cause ideas to proliferate through the system. You know, one teacher might have an interesting idea, which means she's taking a risk, for example. But if other teachers were exposed to that idea and then could decide for themselves whether that's interesting or not, and still there's some accountability because they get to send back some feedback. But overall, what would happen is through this giant social network, these ideas would be proliferating and people would be able to build on each other's ideas. The current system is the exact opposite of that. Basically, it says you can't take any risks or try anything, and anything you do will be basically snuffed out because there's a risk that it might actually lower your objective test score. So all of these interesting, creative, possible stepping stones will never actually be tried or shared or realized at all.
There are systems where teachers are encouraged to do that and where teachers are actually trained like professionals, treated like professionals, even paid like professionals. Finland is an example, and you talk about that example in your book, where they really get to share ideas and make spaces for the kids in which testing is not what it's about. It's really about learning, not only teachers learning from each other, but kids and teachers learning together and sharing and opening up that space of creativity, which paradoxically makes for much higher test scores than going for high test scores.
Yeah, I mean, that could be viewed as an example of evidence in support of my claim here. I mean, Finland, where they are much more in the spirit of the kind of idea I just described, and they get higher test scores. I mean, there's a lot, I've read counter arguments to this, sort of Finland special in lots of ways and so forth. But still, you should at least be concerned, I think, when you see that and you realize that our system is so opposite to that. I mean, we tend to view this kind of following your instincts as a bad thing in our country, in our culture. And in some way, that's like denying all of the investment that we've put into people. I mean, why did we invest all this time educating these teachers if at the end of the day, we don't trust them to have any ideas whatsoever? I mean, all that matters to us is the test score. So basically, we're saying we don't trust you, so you better not try anything that's not part of the way the book is written right now, or else, you know, the test score might go down. And so, in effect, we're denying the expertise that we've created. It's opportunity to flourish and realize its potential.
Now, what about things where an objective seems like a good idea? Like, okay, let's get together some of the great minds in science and try to cure cancer, or let's get people together in material science to try to invent a biodegradable plastic so we no longer have these huge problems in our waterways, stuff like that. I mean, those are objectives.
Okay, yeah, two answers to that. I think the first thing is I want to put out there before I fully answer that question that, of course, objectives are not always bad. You know, and I think it's important to clarify that what we're talking about here are ambitious objectives. If your objective is to go make lunch, then, you know, stopping by the refrigerator is probably a good idea.
Or like when we're in school, you know, I want to get 100 on my math test, so I'm going to study in this
way. Right. And I mean, that's totally reasonable. And I mean, that's an achievable objective. It's relatively modest, and since it's not like curing cancer, you know, getting a good score on your test. So we want to be sure that we understand that I'm not saying like something really out there, like you should just give up all your objectives and just wander around crazily for the rest of your life. We're talking about in the zone of like really creativity and discovery and sort of amazing achievements. So in that world, though, you still might ask your question then, you know, so it's like we do want to cure cancer. So what am I saying? Should we cancel that? And I think it's a really tricky question because, I mean, even myself, you know, I'm in artificial intelligence, and that's actually one of those. You know, creating a bona fide human-level artificial intelligence is just a ridiculously ambitious objective. So many people have asked me kind of jokingly, are you going to give up on that now? You know, because of your theory, you basically shouldn't have any objectives. And my answer is basically for all those things, yeah, I mean, I think it really is true that you can't trust the idea that you're trying to cure cancer or create an AI as a very good guiding light towards actually achieving those things. That's just a bitter pill we have to swallow. But that doesn't mean that we can't sort of explore the space around those questions, you know, which is what I consider myself to be doing. I'm interested in AI. I don't treat it as an objective where I'm measuring everything I do against whether I'm moving towards a true human-level AI. I'm just exploring questions around that zone of intelligence and what it is. It's maybe one step back, one step forward. I don't really care. I'm just doing it out of interest. And I think that's how we have to treat all of these massive endeavors, is sort of let's study these fields, but not as objective, but sort of as areas of inquiry.
And so in cancer, you might explore cell biology in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah, I mean, and it's very possible, and you could probably infer from this whole theory that somebody who's not explicitly trying to cure cancer could be the one who, you know, comes up with the essential stepping stone to curing cancer. That's actually quite likely, you know, if you think about this whole theory. And it could even be something as radical as someone who's not even a biologist. I mean, who knows? It's something out there. All of these stepping stones intertwine, you know, at some very distant point in the future.
How do you think that we've gotten to this point in history where we are so objective driven? It wasn't always like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, a really important question, because I think it is very unhealthy where we've gotten to. And I think part of it has to do with sort of the rise of science, which has led to an inference, which I think is not really true, that basically everything can be dealt with through some kind of quantifiable measure. I mean, we've come to believe this as our confidence has gone up, I would argue, too much in the idea of metrics and accountability, that sort of everything can be reduced to some kind of scientific experiment where we just use an empirical result to cause us to go in the correct direction. You know, this overall theory basically shows that it's in really, really ambitious problems, there's no way that we can create a systematic method to know what leads to what. We just don't know. The future is a fog. And by not acknowledging that, we're being entirely unrealistic, you know, that we don't actually know what the stepping stones are. But we have become so risk averse because we think we've convinced ourselves that we can mitigate all risk, and that we have lost sight of the fact that all discovery requires risk. I mean, that's sort of central to this whole theory, is that if you're exploring things, you know, what is a treasure hunter? It's someone who's willing to take risks, to look in new places, to see what's there, even if we don't know what it might be. And by sort of denying that and saying, well, wait a second, you need to prove to me first, before you go there, that you know where you're going, that's the end of the treasure hunter. And so I think we've basically come to believe that we can basically control our destiny in a way which is entirely unrealistic and removes all risk from the system. And in the process of that, we're basically killing our ability to collect stepping stones and discover new things.
Ken Stanley is a computer scientist, an artificial intelligence researcher. He's an associate professor at the University of Central Florida, and he's on sabbatical this year at the Santa Fe Institute. He's co-author of the new book, Why Greatness Cannot Be Planned, The Myth of the Objective. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. This was a really great opportunity, and I very much appreciate it.
And by the way, people can go to pickbreeder.org if they want to. Have fun with that terrific site.